Good afternoon, everyone. Je suis Christopher Manfredi, doyen de la Faculté des Arts, et je suis très heureux de vous souhaiter la bienvenue cet après-midi. Before we get started, before I ask Dean Ellen Aitken of the Faculty of Religious Studies to introduce our guest lecturer, I'd just like to say, I'll give you a little bit of information and say a little bit about the Kundal Prize in History at McGill. The late Peter Kundal, a graduate of McGill University, a BCom graduate, wanted to recognize and promote literary and academic achievement in history. The apocryphal story about that is that he once failed a course in history as an undergraduate at McGill, and this was his revenge for that. But for that reason, or his great love of history, he established the Kundal Prize in History at McGill University, otherwise known as simply the Kundal Prize, to be offered each year by the university to an individual of any nationality who has published a book determined to have had or likely to have a profound literary, social, and academic impact in the area of history. The university, thanks to the generosity of Mr. Kundal, grants a grand prize of $75,000 and two recognition of excellence prizes of $10,000 US each. In addition to the literary prizes, Mr. Kundal saw the advantage of not only rewarding present achievement in historical scholarship, but in preparing the future generation of historical scholars, and that is why he also added two $25,000 doctoral fellowships in history to his gift as well, for which Faculty of Arts, McGill University, and I'm sure the Department of History are quite grateful. The recipients of the Kundal Prize in History are selected by an independent jury of at least five internationally distinguished and qualified individuals selected by the university each year. Thus far, the prize has spotlighted authors from a variety of regions, including Stuart Schwartz from the United States, Lisa Jardine from the United Kingdom, our guest this afternoon, Dermot McCulloch of the United Kingdom, and the 2011 Grand Prize winner, Sergio Luzzatto of Italy, recognizing the first book written in a language, originally written in a language other than English, and then translated to English. As has been the tradition, the Grand Prize winner comes to Montreal to deliver a public lecture, which brings us here this afternoon. Before I invite Dean Aitken to the podium, I'd like to thank her and her colleagues for their help in filling the room. As you see, they've been quite successful. I would also like to let you know that the chair of the Department of History, Professor Zuki, will moderate the question period following Professor McCulloch's presentation, and that the director of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, which is responsible for the logistics of administering the prize, Will Straw, will say a few words of thanks at the end. Now I'd like to invite Ellen Aitken, Dean of the Faculty of Religious Studies, to come to the podium and introduce Professor McCulloch.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Chris. I'm especially delighted to introduce Professor McCulloch because my own field is early Christian history and literature. So I would like to welcome all of you here this afternoon to the Kundal Prize Lecture, and I'd particularly like to welcome back to McGill Professor Dermot McCulloch, the 2010 winner of the Kundal Prize for his book, A History of Christianity, The First 3,000 Years. You want to know the answer to why 3,000 years, you have to read the book. Professor McCulloch is professor of the history of the church at Oxford University, a fellow of St. Cross College in that university, and a lecturer in the Faculty of Theology, where he has taught since 1995. He has earned degrees from Cambridge University, where he received an MA with first-class honors in the historical tripos, a PhD in church history under the supervision of Sir Geoffrey Elton, one of the great figures in the history of the church. As well, he has received diplomas from the University of Liverpool and Ripon College, Cuddesdon. In 2001, he received a Doctorate of Divinity from Oxford and has been celebrated with honorary degrees from the University of East Anglia and from Virginia Theological Seminary in the United States. Professor McCulloch is a fellow of the British Academy as well as of the Royal Historical Society and the Society of Antiquaries of London. And most recently, he was knighted in the 2012 New Year's Honours List, though he has carefully instructed us that as a cleric in the Church of England, he is an ecclesiastical knight and therefore not to be addressed as Sir. Right? A specialist in the history of 16th century England and the English Church and the Anglican Reformation, Professor McCulloch's books include, to name only a few, works that are essential reading for all scholars of this period, including Suffolk and the Tudors, Politics and Religion in an English County, 1500 to 1600, the later Reformation in England, 1547 to 1603, and where I first became most acquainted with his scholarship, Thomas Cranmer, A Life, and to give it its North American title, Reformation, Europe's House Divided. And of course, that monumental and endlessly fascinating work, Christianity, the First 3,000 Years. Professor McCulloch's scholarship and writing combine that scholarly care for details, the love of the particular, the local, and the regional, with a view of the broad horizon, the persistent issues, and the ongoing dynamic tensions in the history of Christianity. He does so with elegance, courtesy, and respect. He makes history alive and visible and tangible to our senses. He whets our curiosity time and time again as he pursues the constant intertwining of politics, religion, culture, controversy, and vision. So this afternoon, Professor McCulloch will deliver the Kundal Prize lecture entitled Christianity and Islam, Way Stations on a Journey, a lecture I think particularly well suited for McGill. And there'll be time at the end for questions. Professor McCulloch, it is my great delight to welcome you this afternoon, and I do so with immense gratitude for your scholarship and your insight. Please join with me in welcoming Professor McCulloch.
Thank you, Dean Aitken, for that very generous introduction. It's a delight to be back in Montreal for my visit last year. And with the occasion being such a generous gesture towards the humanities by the Kundal family, it is marvelous that a man in business had the vision to create this prize. I'm very sad that I didn't meet Peter Kundal before his death. But his name will live on in this act of extraordinary generosity and wisdom which has benefited this university and has benefited scholarship generally. There is no need to justify my subject. It is clear in the modern age that two great world faiths need to understand each other. And at lightning speed, I will give you a rundown on the history of their relationship. One little bread and butter footnote, I'll use the common era system of dating. So BC is BCE and AD is CE. It seems only courteous to do so when you're discussing a world faith which doesn't accept the premises of BC and AD. Well, the reason you have a sheet in front of you is to emphasize something really obvious, that there is no one identity for Christianity any more than there is one identity for Islam. Christianity has never been a single united church since it first emerged in Palestine. And the first great fault line you see on your sheet was when one section of it was offered official patronage by a Roman emperor, Constantine, in the early 4th century. From then on, there is an imperial Christianity within the bounds of the Roman Empire. That Christianity, again, looking at the left-hand side of your sheet, you see fragmented between a Latin-speaking church in the West, which looked to the only Western patriarch, the Bishop of Rome, and a Greek-speaking East, closely allied with the emperors in Constantinople, which was the first and origin of the so-called Orthodox churches, descending into the various language families of Bulgarian Orthodoxy, Serbian Orthodoxy, Romanian Orthodoxy, etc., etc. And just to confuse things, the western half of this imperial Christianity further fragmented in the 16th century to produce Roman Catholicism and Protestantisms. Plural, you note, not singular, Protestantisms. So that's your left-hand side of the sheet. Now look at the other side, the right-hand side. Christianities which spread east and south from Jerusalem beyond the bounds of the Roman Empire. There you have a set of churches which did not listen to the Roman emperors. And when the emperors tried to impose a version of Christianity, try to solve the problem of the natures of Christ, human and divine, when they did so at the Council of Chalcedon in the year 451, these churches refused the deal. They would not sign up to the emperor's deal, but they rejected it as it was a compromise, and so they rejected it from opposite wings. Because the emperor was trying to find a middle ground, there were people on either side of it who did not want the middle ground. Non-Chalcedonian Christianity, therefore, divided, two fiercely opposed in families of churches, which still are divided, as I discovered when we filmed with them in the Middle East. They have not forgotten that moment of 451. One side emphasizes the oneness in the natures of Christ, the Miaphysites or Monophysites, and the other, the two-ness of the natures of Christ, human and divine, the Diaphysites, which their enemies have condescendingly labelled Nestorians. So that's what your handout is for. It is to show you just how varied Christianity has been right from the outset. And you'll notice that some of those names and pieces of information there are in italics. And that's simply to show you when they encountered Islam, at which stage each of them encountered this new monotheism. Variety, then, is the spice of life, it's the spice of history, and it's the truth about both these great world faiths. And so, because there was so much variety, the outcome of their contacts was equally liable to be varied. Often, one variety of Christianity was pitted against another with an Islamic ally. Let's start with the first non-Muslim encounters with Christianity, almost exclusively with non-imperial Christianity, the Christianities beyond the empire, in the Arabian Peninsula in particular, where in the time of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, there were already two sorts of non-Chalcedonian Christians. There were the Miaphysites on the one hand, the Diophysites on the other. Arabia was up for grabs at the time as to which world faith, Judaism, or one sort of Christianity would be its way forward. And the Quran is surprisingly, strikingly preoccupied with the two monotheisms which Muhammad had known since his boyhood, Judaism and Christianity. The Prophet was concerned to proclaim a new unity of religion through the God associated with the great shrine at Mecca. But otherwise, Muhammad spoke contemptuously of Arabian traditional religions. He was very aware of the sacred books which had previously spoken of one God, in other words, the Tanakh, the Hebrew scriptures, and the Christian New Testament. And as is well known, the mother of Mary's name, the mother of Jesus' name, occurs almost twice as often in the Quran as it does in the New Testament. And she gives her name to one of its surahs. By contrast, there's one silence in the Quran which I think is extremely significant, quite startling once you notice it. The name of Paul of Tarsus is nowhere in the Quran. And that provokes interesting reflection, which we might come back to in question time. So far from speaking a new message, Muhammad proclaimed Islam as the original truth, which later centuries had obscured. Christian apologists had done the same thing with Judaism in the second century. Muhammad's theme of oneness is a clear contrast with the Christian quarrels which he knew about the natures of Christ and which I've illustrated for you on your handout. And his successors in this monotheism, Islam, borrowed a great deal from Christianity, not so much in concept as in practice. There's much in modern Muslim practice which would have been completely familiar to 7th century Christians, and which is likely to be borrowed. Ramadan, a feast which has all the intensity of the Christian Lent. The characteristic prostration of Muslim prayer was then normal in the Christian Middle East, where it still survives in some traditional Christian communities. Prayer mats, one of the most familiar features of the mosque, were extensively used by Christian monks as far apart as Syria and Northumbria in England. And they're reflected, for instance, in the English tradition, in the aptly named carpet pages of Northumbrian manuscripts, such as the great Lindisfarne Gospels. Those pages are probably representations of prayer mats within the Christian tradition. And then there is the phenomenon of the holy man. Saints proliferated in 4th to 7th century Christianity, and many of them were taken straight over by Islam, and they remain the focus of Islamic cult to the present day. And Islam has developed its own holy men and pilgrimages alongside these older holy men, at least in some of its forms. Above all, there is that architectural symbol of Islam, the minaret. Now, as far as I know, there is no obvious prescription for minarets in the Quran or any Islamic source which might be considered primary. So where did it come from? What were its origins? Well, I'm not the first person to point out to the pillar saints of Christian Syria, the so-called stylites, who followed the example of St. Simeon the Elder and preached to crowds from pillars on which they dwelt, often for decades. And so the first Arab invaders of Syria would have seen those Syrian Christian holy men summoning the faithful to worship from a stone pillar. And the first known minaret, after all, appears to be that of the great Umayyad Mosque in Damascus, which is prime pillar saint country. This is within the world of the stylites. Let's stick with Syria, because at the time of Muhammad's successors, this took us from outside the imperial Christian range to the imperial Christianity. Now Muslims began encountering imperial Christianity, particularly in one city which the Byzantine Empire had painfully won back, just at the time of Muhammad's life and work, Jerusalem. Now, if you read the Quran, it becomes apparent quite quickly that Muhammad's relationship with Judaism was much more conflicted than that with Christianity. And that, I think, paradoxically, is because it was much more intimate. This was the quarrel between two very closely related streams of thought. It's possible to interpret the prophet's sense of his own identity as the last in the succession of Hebrew prophets in the peninsula which had Jews wielding supreme power in the kingdom of Himyar only a few years before Muhammad's ministry and prophecies. In which case, Muhammad's initial mission was a resolve to restore a monotheism looking to the temple in Jerusalem, which Christians had desecrated and turned into a rubbish heap. When, after the prophet's death, the conqueror Umar entered Jerusalem, it was in deliberate humility. He knew that he was fulfilling the design of the prophet in doing so. But he signified the triumph of Islam on the vacant site of the temple, building a mosque above the desecrated ruins at the polar opposite end of the city from the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, right at the other end, where the Jews had experienced maximum humiliation from Christians. And so the caliph achieved a splendor on this ancient sacred site, which Christians had deliberately spurned and kept vacant, and whose memory had been so vital for the prophet. In the early 690s, the Caliph Abd al-Malik outdid Umar's first monument by building the Dome of the Rock, so-called, not a mosque at all. What was it? Originally, it seems to have been intended as a victory monument, the victory of Islam over Christianity, creating a building which would be as impressive as anything which Christianity had created, for instance, Hagia Sophia in Constantinople, which by now was the goal of Islam. They wished to be a new empire, to take this greatest city of their world and make it Islamic. Well, that would be postponed, but now there was a symbol of that aim in Jerusalem, the Dome of the Rock. Ironically, although it reversed Christian mistreatment of the temple, it was probably built by Christian craftsmen, and its architectural forms are derived from Islam, from Byzantium. Now, in the Middle East, and increasingly around the shores of Africa, most Christians would have to live with a new reality. They had lost their position at the center of society, which they had come to enjoy during the Roman Empire. But they'd also been on the verge of enjoying it in the Sasanian Empire beyond the imperial frontiers. But outside the Arabian Peninsula, there was no policy of replacing Christianity. Islam was not a missionary faith. It was a military elite. And two or more centuries passed before there was anything like a Muslim majority in these areas. And Christians made agreements with their rulers, which were conventionally known as the Pacts or Covenants of Umar, and versions of them were in place until the 20th century in various parts of the Umar, the Muslim world. And why not? Neither Diaphysites nor Miaphysites had any reason to regret the Arab conquest. Why should they worry if the Byzantine Christians were conquered and humiliated? These were, after all, heretics. Why not take on the rule of other heretics? And then they found ways of cooperating with the new regime, crucial ways. The Abbasid dynasty founded a new imperial capital, Baghdad. And in Baghdad, there were, of course, many Christians. And think of the position of Baghdad in what is now Iraq. It's outside the Roman imperial frontiers. It's in the Sasanian, former Sasanian Empire. And the Christianity of this area is Diaphysite. It is Nestorian, if you want that word. And the patriarch of the Diaphysite Church, the Church of the East, became a hugely important political figure within the Abbasid setup. He was given power over whoever Christians the Abbasids ruled. For a moment, this patriarch of the East had jurisdiction over more Christians than the Bishop of Rome. At that stage, Baghdad could have been the center of the Christian world, not Rome. And the consequences here were very interesting, because what happened to these Christians in Baghdad was that they became the think tank of the dynasty. They copied and translated the Greek manuscripts which they had, which they possessed. They were the transmitters of Greek learning, science, philosophy to the Abbasids. Why did they know about it? Because they had used this Greek philosophy to argue with fellow Christians about the natures of Christ. They were the experts, and so they translated all this material for the benefit of Muslims. The Abbasids benefited intellectually from the quarrels of Christians, just as their conquering predecessors had benefited militarily from those same quarrels. So if this is one example of creative cooperation between the two faith communities, elsewhere in the Christian world there was another sort of borrowing, but this time the other way, from Islam to Christianity. It resulted in one of the greatest conflicts in Christian history, mainly in Greek-speaking Christianity, but, as we'll see, with fallout in the Latin West as well. This was the iconoclast controversy, begun in the time of an 8th century Byzantine emperor called Leo. He had been born on the frontier with Islam in Asia Minor, and it may be that already there he was impressed by Muslim austerity. and by one particular aspect of that austerity, the rejection of all images of the divine. That contrasted significantly with one growing feature of devotion within Byzantine Christianity, the importance, indeed, often what seemed like the divine power of images, icons. Muslims detested such images. They confronted people in Byzantium who adored such images. And militarily, Islam seemed to be winning. What did that say about God's attitude to images? Certainly that's how the Leo saw the problem. Leo decided that the Muslims were winning because they had rejected images. And so he would do the same. He would turn the Byzantine Empire away from the cult of images towards an aniconic Christian faith. That was in the 8th century. It took 100 years for the Byzantine Empire to decide this matter, one of the greatest, most destructive internal conflicts it faced. And at the end, to cut an enormously long story short, the icon lovers won in what has been called the Triumph of Orthodoxy, which is a name given to it after the event. That would be the future of Orthodoxy. And it's all down, you see, to an attempted Christian borrowing from Islam, iconophobia, hatred of images. And the Latin West took up the same impulse. In the time of the new self-made emperor, Charlemagne, Charles the Great, and this too had long reverberations in Christian practice. Partly, Charlemagne got interested in the idea of banning images because at that moment, Byzantium had gone back to them. And he was the rival of the what you might call the real Roman emperor in Constantinople. He wished to be an emperor in the West. And so he commissioned a theological treatise on this matter. It's known to historians as the Caroline Books, the Libri Carolini, whose arguments are designed to show that images are bad things. It sneered in an interesting political way at the Byzantine emperors for having images of themselves around, and said that these were gathering the sort of worship, veneration, which was unhealthy and was not allowed for human beings. So you can see the political dimension of what Charlemagne was doing. And we know that at the same time, he was putting out diplomatic feelers to the Abbasid Caliph, Harun al-Rashid, far away in Baghdad, to try and outflank the Byzantine emperor. The concrete result of that was the arrival of an elephant at Charlemagne's court in Germany. Elephant lived at Aachen for 9 years. So you could dismiss Charlemagne's gestures towards getting rid of images as a political thing, but there was a more profound theological unease at work here too. A number of Charlemagne's leading theologians were Spaniards. They, like the Emperor Leo, were on the frontier between Christianity and Islam. And they drew the same conclusion. As Muslims pressed to the Iberian Peninsula, it was very natural to see their success as, again, the favor of God against those who had got rid of images. And Charlemagne made one of those Spaniards bishop in Orléans. His name was Theodulf, and he does seem to have been the author of the Libri Carolini. So we can see a direct link between Charlemagne's policies and this theological anxiety of Spanish theologians. And actually, if we go to a little church in France called Germigny-les-Prés, you see there Theodulf's private chapel, because he was also abbot of a great monastery in the Loire. And there, about 120 years ago, a mosaic was uncovered. It is exquisite, but it is also iconoclast art. Unlike most mosaics that we're familiar with, it has no images, divine images, in it at all. No picture of God, only his hand descending. And that hand is the hand of the divine covenant with humanity, as if we're grasping it for a handshake. But instead, underneath is a picture of the Ark of the Covenant. It's an extraordinary thing to stand in that tiny church in the Loire Valley and see a piece of iconoclast art straight out the iconoclast impulse of both East and West at the time. It was a mood which passed in the West. Even Charlemagne was a little half-hearted about it. But it was to come back in the West. In the 16th century, the same mood, as we'll see, took over one of those Protestantisms. And surprise, surprise, they printed for the first time the Libri Carolini of Charlemagne. Well, that's one elephant in the drawing room in Aachen. There is another elephant in the story of Christian Islam, Islamic relations, the Crusades. Now, in the 11th and 12th century, the Western Latin Church really did make aggressive moves against Islam outside its own homeland. But it's important to see what the Crusades actually were. They were the last outwash of a tide of Northern European conquest, which had not started by being specifically Christian at all. The Crusades were the end game in an extraordinary series of waves of energy coming out of Scandinavia through the people variously known as Norsemen, Rus, Varangians, and finally Normans. They had once burned Christian churches and monasteries and ravaged Christian society from England and Ireland through to Russia and Byzantium. Only when they turned their attention to France and Italy did they become devout Christians. And their first foray against Islam was not in Palestine, but in Sicily and southern Italy. These Normans simply wanted those places, and so they invaded them and seized them. At first, the Bishop of Rome, the Pope, did not approve of this at all, because the Byzantine Emperor had interest in these places. But then the Normans soundly defeated the Pope in battle in 1053, and from then on, the papacy was in alliance with the Normans. It had a mutual interest with them in promoting its own power. For instance, in 1066, it backed another Norman invasion into England by William the Norman, who became King of England. Speculative ventures all. But then, at the end of the 11th century, came the greatest speculative adventure of any of them, the trip to Jerusalem, the First Crusade. A bunch of Normans turned up in Jerusalem, conquered it, massacred Jews, massacred Muslims, and founded a Latin kingdom there. It utterly bewildered Muslims. What were these people doing there? There seemed to be no reason at all why they should have any particular interest. The reasons were entirely to do with the internal dynamics of Western society. It was not surprising that they took Muslims by surprise. And that moment of surprise was enough to gain them the Latin kingdom of Jerusalem, but it was not enough to keep them there. That was the Westerners' problem. All the prodigious expenditure of heroism and resources over the next two centuries were all futile. No crusade ever equaled the success of the first. That initial victory was a disastrous illusion. At a moment of accidental Muslim weakness. But again and again, they tried. The piling up of evidence to the contrary did not prevent the triumph of hope over experience, provoking catastrophe after catastrophe. And of course, as this well-informed audience will know, one of the great disasters was the Fourth Crusade, when those Western armies turned not to fight Islam, but to wreck Constantinople and found yet another carpet-banging kingdom in the great city, the Latin Empire of Byzantium. The effect was further to drive apart Christians between East and West. The Orthodox have never forgotten that venture of 1204. Well, so far, quite familiar. But let's remember the other catastrophe for Christian faith represented by the Crusades. That catastrophe was for the non-Chalcedonian churches, the non-imperial churches. Up till now, their Muslim overlords had treated them as part of society, as, to some extent, collaborators, colleagues, you might say. But now, Christians had shown themselves a threat to Muslim power. And so, now, a new status for these peoples, steadily more oppressed, steadily regarded as the enemies of Islam, not the friends of Islam. This is the time when the Copts in Egypt started facing hostility from the dynasty, and hostility which they had never faced to any systematic extent before. And just at that moment, the great destructive people, the Mongols, began making a decision as to which world faith they would go for. Previously, it looked as if they might become Christians. And it was still with that in mind that they invaded the Muslim world at this very moment. Instead, just enough princes became Muslims. And that possibility of survival for the future was robbed from these non-Chalcedonian churches, a double disaster then at the same time. Well, there were positive results of the Crusades, and one of the most interesting and one of the least acknowledged until recent years was this very university that we're in. Institutions like this were in fact Muslim institutions. All the apparatus of the Western Latin University, degrees, lectures, titles like professor, were all there in the Muslim world before they were ever discovered by Western Europe. Why did Western Europe borrow them? Because of all the knowledge which had suddenly emerged in the East. Greek philosophy, all the works of Aristotle, one by one coming out of this world from Arabic translations into Latin. And you needed some institution to process this extraordinary, frightening, exhilarating band of knowledge. If the Crusades hadn't happened, well, we might not have been in McGill today. So let's say a hurrah for that. And let's move on into the Reformation, the 16th century. By that time, the period I know best, Western Christians thought mostly of Muslims in terms of the Ottoman Empire, the great power which was pushing on the frontiers of Christendom, pushing it back bit by bit, first Constantinople, then Belgrade, falling one by one. It's not surprising that this relationship was a very tense one. It was about warfare. But the Reformation hugely complicated this relationship. Notoriously, Luther and his survivors, in other words, Protestants, might not have survived at all if the Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V, had not been distracted by his worries about the Ottoman Empire. That's why he did not press those princes in the empire who called themselves Protestants. You might say that Protestantism owes its existence to Islam. Western Europe was not always divided on this matter. Various Protestants did cooperate with their hated fellow Catholics. For instance, at the Battle of Lepanto in 1571, which in many ways does represent a halt to Islamic expansion. There were Protestants among the ranks of the soldiers on the Christian galleys at Lepanto, and it was one of the very few moments in the Reformation where Protestants might feel real pleasure at a Catholic success, or could at least envy Catholic noblemen for doing what they would want to do and be Christian chivalrous knights. Far away in Scotland, for instance, the young Protestant king of Scotland, James VI, wrote an epic poem celebrating the Battle of Lepanto and Don Juan of Austria's achievement at that battle. But if you read the poem, it's a celebration of the defense of Christendom, King James's confusion of feelings is very obvious. He actually had this work published in Edinburgh in the 1590s, and he wrote a preface to it, constrained to explain rather uncomfortably why, I quote, contrary to my degree and religion, like a mercenary poet, a Protestant monarch had written, in praise of a foreign papist bastard. That is Don John of Austria. And King James tacked onto the end of his work a poetic health warning. God doth love his name so well that so he did them aid that served not right the same. That is, Catholics not serving God aright. Still, they had won the Battle of Lepanto. It was confusing for a Protestant monarch. And the fact was that Protestants might loathe Catholics more than they did Muslims, from Luther onwards. And from the beginning of his career as a reformer, Luther said that true Christians should reject any resort to crusade. That was for papists. And Christians living under Islamic rule might be missionaries to their rulers. So it was a good thing that they had the chance to be living under Muslim rulers, just as Protestants should minister to Catholics and try and convert them to the true faith. And in fact, if you look at Luther's anti-Islamic polemic, he was very good at being rude to people he didn't like. It's interesting that it's the papacy to which he always refers, and he regards Catholicism as worse than Islam. He saw both the Quran and the theology of the Pope as having a theology of works, good works, and not faith alone. They were both misleading. But actually, Muslims were more admirable because their society was better regulated. They were more moral people than Catholics were. That, of course, in one sense, made Islam more pernicious, more dangerous than Catholicism, because any right-minded person could see that Catholicism was wrong. But you might well admire Muslims and their way of life. And there were other Protestants besides Luther, who in rather complicated ways developed Luther's ideas and took a different attitude again to Muslims. These were the so-called Reformed Protestants. If you want to use a crude more term for them, you could call them Calvinists, but Reformed Protestants is a more embracing way of referring to them. Now, these Protestants had one thing in common with Muslims which put them at odds not just with Luther, but with the Pope as well. Reformed Protestants hated visual representations of the sacred. As I've said already, it was Reformed Protestants who put Charlemagne's books against images, the Libri Carolini, into print in 1549 in Geneva. And part of that Reformed world was the Kingdom of England. Never a Lutheran Protestant country. Lutheranism has never had any part in the history of English religion. It was a Reformed Protestant kingdom, first under King Edward VI and then under Queen Elizabeth I. Now, Queen Elizabeth I, rather against her better judgment, found herself engaged in a world war against the Habsburgs, the King of Spain in particular. And, naturally, she sent out diplomatic feelers against the greatest enemy of the King of Spain, the Sultan in Constantinople. She even went to the extent of dispatching an English organ builder, Thomas Dalham by name, to Constantinople, armed with crates full of a pipe organ, a novelty pipe organ, which would entrance the Sultan, and it worked, unfortunately, so well that when Thomas Dalham built his organ in Constantinople, the Sultan was so delighted that he kept Thomas Dalham locked up and offered him a harem of wives. And Dalham took a long time to escape from there. He wrote up his adventures. They make a wonderful story. I do recommend it. So this is rather unexpected, Reformed Protestants and Muslims getting together against the common papist enemy. And it went on. Elizabeth I allied with the Muslim ruler of Morocco, Ahmad al-Mansur, who had declared himself in 1590 the Mahdi, the awaited one. But the Mahdi's fight was not with Queen Elizabeth I. It was, of course, with Spain. The King of Spain was oppressing his Muslim subjects and, in fact, would expel them all in 1609. And so in 1596, the Mahdi and Queen Elizabeth I mounted a joint naval expedition against Spain. It captured and sacked the city of Cadiz. And my own university has great reason to be grateful to this, since the Bodleian Library contains a large section of the Bishop's Library looted from Cadiz in 1596. The raid was a tremendous success. And so, in 1603, al-Mansur proposed to Queen Elizabeth I a follow-up exhibition. They should jointly attack the Spaniards in their American colonies and set up their own Anglo-Moroccan colony in North America, which, he said, given the hot climate, would be better settled by Moroccans than English people. Well, who knows? It might have happened, but Al-Mansur died of the plague that same year. But it's one reminder again that Protestants might hate Catholics, idolatrous Spanish Catholics, much more than they did iconophobic Muslims. And it suggests an interesting alternative history for the United States of America. And Al-Mansur's death was not the end for this interesting alignment. There were quite a number of Englishmen in North Africa in the early 17th century, and many of them converted to Islam. Very few examples of conversion the other way, incidentally, all through Christian history. But even those who did not convert to Islam were fascinated by a religion which showed at that moment a preoccupation with the last days, just as much as Reformed Protestants did in Europe. And they also realized that the fury in the Muslim world at the expulsion of the Spanish Muslims was something to work in their favor. And they linked up once more with an important political figure in Morocco. Abu Makhili, self-styled descendant of the Prophet, who excited very many members of the London mercantile community in Morocco. Two of them interviewed him in 1612 and wrote up an account of it, which is the first English account of a conversation with a Muslim. And there, in this conversation, Abu Makhili reassured them that he had no designs on Protestant Northern Europe. His quarrel was entirely with Spain, and he sought, again, a military alliance. But he's also careful to praise the sufferings of Christians, and he stressed the prominent role of Christ in the Quran. This was a well-informed military leader. An envoy of King James I didn't actually meet him, but again, fascinated by him, and he noted that this false prophetical king, as he called him, was being used by God as part of his plans for the last days. And that conviction was only increased when Abu Makhili was killed in battle in 1613. It was all of a piece with English Reformed Protestants' conviction that the last days were at hand and Muslims would be an ally in this. A new conviction in English Christianity, but one which has never actually left Anglophone Christianity, because the descendants of Englishmen like that envoy of James I, are to be found fueling the American religious right's preoccupation with the state of Israel. They seem to have forgotten that once their Protestant forebears were equally excited by Islam. Now, in the same era, far to the east, in the Ottoman Empire, the impulse continued. The English and the French vied for trade in Syria and set up permanent missions. And it was difficult when you had a permanent mission in a place like Aleppo constantly to be hostile and ignorant to the Muslims that you met. Let's jump forward in that story in Syria and the Middle East, across the barrier of the European Enlightenment, which is often seen as one of the great gulfs between Islam and Christianity. But let me take you to a curious and significant incident in late Ottoman Beirut in 1876. Well, Beirut then boasted a mission of local American Protestants who set up the ancestor of the American University, which still exists there, very distinguished. And as part of their drive to bring both Christianity and Western Enlightenment to Beirut, they started a journal called Al-Muqtataf. And as its name implied, it consisted of selections from the various works of scientific interest and Christianity and Enlightenment, all translated into Arabic there. And in its first year of publication, it published a series of articles on the Copernican solar system and on Isaac Newton. And these provoked a furious response in Beirut, but not from the local Islamic authorities, but from the Christians. A Christian with the orthodox title of Archimandrite of Antioch, Gabriel Jabara, confidently proclaimed that the fixity of the earth in the cosmos was not only proved in recent scientific publications in Beirut, but could also not be doubted because of the Bible, which provided, I quote, a clearly written account of the true state of the natural world and all its elements. Very alarming for the American Protestant missionaries. But there came an unexpected intervention.
the Orthodox Archimandrite's geocentric arguments were ridiculed and refuted from an impeccable Muslim source in Cairo. Abdallah al-Fikri, then an astronomer at the court of Khedive Ismail. Al-Fikri obtained from the Minister of Education in Cairo the statement that this opinion of Jabara was clearly wrong and corrupt, both religiously and scientifically. Al-Fikri went on to produce a defense of heliocentricity, which was not only just published by the relieved Protestant editors of Al-Muqtataf in Beirut, but also in a Cairo-based journal of science sponsored by the Education Minister of the Khedive and the Egyptian Bureau of Schools. So once more, Protestantism and Islam combined against a Christianity which regarded itself as the exclusive repository of an authentic tradition. Both Protestant Christianity and Egyptian Islam might then both see themselves as the bearers of enlightenment. And indeed, at much the same time, the Grand Mufti of Egypt, Muhammad Abdu, not only saw Islam as an important aid to scientific inquiry, but he echoed Protestant critiques of Catholic suppression of science. He said that Christianity, not Islam, I quote, had a history of persecuting men of science. And given what happened to Galileo, you could say he had some justification for that view. Well, these are interesting 19th century alignments. And they show that at the root of modern, apparently, faith confrontations is not some unchanging, seamless ideological hatred, but a shift in world power during the 19th century. The decay of two great Muslim empires, the Ottomans in the Middle East and the Mughals in India, and the takeover by Europeans of their power. Some European imperial expansion continued to go back to the Crusades for its rhetoric. So Louis-Philippe of France, a slightly shaky monarch, decided to bolster his power by decorating one of the rooms at Versailles with pictures of the Crusades, just as his armies were going into Algeria to conquer them as a French colony. But this fit between power and faith was not exact at all. Much British Christian missionary effort, for instance, was not easy with British imperial government at all. They had different aims. Much of that effort was from evangelical Protestant Christians who were not part of the Anglican establishment. They had no great sympathy with what the government was doing. And in fact, in India, they faced opposition from the colonial authorities, the Honorable East India Company, which, as it extended its power through India, was extremely wary of disturbing Hindu and Islamic sensibilities. Eventually, evangelical pressure in the British Parliament forced them to let the missionaries in. The results were disastrous. It was one of the great elements in the so-called Indian Mutiny, or First Indian War of Independence, in 1857 to 58. And that catastrophe for British government discredited any further efforts of the British government to back missionary efforts in India at all. By the end of the century, Great Britain had to recognize that in terms of territory and numbers of subjects, it was in fact the largest Muslim power in the world. Any effort to eliminate Islam would have been madness. And there are curious other bouncing of billiard balls in this story of imperial triumph of the West during the 19th century. For instance, so much of that power was based on steam power, and that steam power was applied to shipping in the end. And that revolution in world transport, the steamship, had a very significant result for Muslims worldwide. It made the Hajj much easier. It meant that Muslims from as far away as the East Indies, from the farthest end of Africa, could get to Mecca by steamship. The Muslim world was vastly united as a result of this Western innovation. And so thousands on thousands, millions on millions did the Hajj via steamship. It was such a change in scale that it provoked a curious set of Western fears about disease, cholera. So one 19th century British doctor exclaimed, I quote, "Mecca, I hold, is the place of danger for Europe, a perpetual menace to the Western world." Well, where have we heard that sort of sentiment before? In the 19th century, it was directed towards cholera, quite irrationally. Now, let us judge whether similar sentiments are equally irrational. So in the 19th century, the disintegration of Muslim power in India had been the greatest theatre for European Muslim conflict. In the 20th, it became the disintegration of the Ottoman Empire, and of course one corner of it, Palestine. The British, the last culturally Christian rulers of Palestine, left in disarray in 1948. And as the Israelis occupied lands not allotted to them by international agreement, Europeans did nothing to intervene, mostly out of a sense of shame as to what had gone on not in the Middle East, but in Europe, in the camps of Auschwitz and the like. So the West assuaged its conscience at the expense of the suffering, flight, or mass expulsion of much of the non-Jewish population of Palestine. And since then, in recent decades, the interests of some ultra-conservative American Protestant Christians have bizarrely coincided with those of intransigent politicians in the State of Israel. Protestants, who eagerly await the return of Jesus Christ in the last days, follow biblical references in believing this will only happen when the Jews are back in the land of Israel, ready to be converted. And although the Israeli right is not at all ready to be converted, this is an extremely convenient alliance. And such Christian-inspired support from Israel takes little account of the Palestinian people, a sad irony when you consider that a significant proportion of them are fellow Christians to American Protestants. It's not surprising that the misuse of Western power has provoked extreme reactions among some Muslims. Moderation and tolerance have been difficult to preserve in the face of two centuries of Western arrogance. And I think there are several lessons to be drawn from the story of the last two centuries. First is to note what a secondary role propositions of religious belief have entered the story since 1800. The tale is of power politics, social shifts, accidents, coincidences. And second, that the story has been dominated by a particular sort of power politics, the rise and fall of great empires. Religions do not equate with empires, necessarily. Two centuries of confrontations between Western Christian powers and Islam should not be read as an inevitable clash of civilizations. The world has always been a scary place, and it's particularly scary now. But we do ourselves no favors if our fears lead us to misread how our present troubles have arisen. If we invent clashes of culture, clashes of civilizations, on the basis of past traumatic moments like the siege of Jerusalem in 1099, or by frantically oversimplifying cultures of which we know little, then we will look for the wrong solutions to real problems. There is no substitute for the pursuit of knowledge. Through such knowledge, we may begin to draw away from the unhappy story of the last two centuries to new way stations. And we need our historical skills to do so, which is why the Kandel benefaction is such a precious witness to the value of history. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. McCullough. We're going to open up to question period now. I've got 10 to 15 minutes, and I've been told to enforce that, so I'm going to ask for your cooperation. First of all, we've had our lecture, so if you have a question, please do ask a question and keep it brief. Secondly, get your hand up high, please, if you have a question. I'll be off to the side over here. And thirdly, come up to one of the two mics. They're in the two aisles. Will the first person at each mic please turn the mic on? Both mics are off.
You have been very articulate in explaining that many of the so-called differences between religious groups have more to do with politics than matters of faith. But yet you did suggest that in a secondary or tertiary way, these religious differences do play a part. And this seems to be somewhat of a paradox until one begins to realize that what is happening at the highest levels of government is something different than what is happening among the masses. And it would seem to me that as a student of politics, one could argue that power is far more important than the matter of religious differences. But at the mass level, in order to gain popular support for policies, in order to have soldiers who are willing to die for their faiths, it seems to me that the religious differences do play a rather important part.
I think that's a very fair comment. But what one needs to do in such circumstances is to ask why so many hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of people, are looking in a particular direction, shouting a particular slogan, feeling particular angers. What are the motives behind this? What are the circumstances which have created these appeals to their tradition, our tradition? Because our traditions contain so much, and only certain parts of them light up at any one particular moment. And sometimes it will be one issue, sometimes another. At the moment, it seems in the Christian world primarily to be sex. And you might say that that's one of the reasons why so much of Islam is also angry. A particular sort of social conservatism has its nerves jangled by a particular sort of phenomenon in the modern world. So yes, certainly, no question that some phenomena, mass angers, are religious in character. But then you have to ask, well, why has that spotlight been turned on the sacred literature? Why is it that at this moment and not another?
Thank you.
It doesn't sound as the mic's on.
Can you hear me? Yes.
Yep.
I'd like to thank you for your talk. It was very interesting. I have two questions. The first one is general. I'm wondering if your research, if you look at Sufism, because there's been a lot of documentation on the absorption of the two religions. And then I was very interested in the way in which you talked about the different forms of borrowing. And I have a very specific question. Penelope Doob, a medievalist, has looked at the circular dancing that priests in the 12th and 13th century did on labyrinths that were built in the floors of churches. Mm. And I was wondering if there's been any work done on similarities between that circular movement that was supposed to, in a sense, build about the cosmic order and the whirling dances of the Arab world that became standardized in the Mevlevi order in 1273.
Yeah, that's a tremendously interesting set of questions, and in fact, I saw time was going, so I actually cut out one of these possible borrowings, which is in fact between Sufism and the Orthodox movement known as hesychasm, which is a movement of quiet contemplation, release, and one doesn't know where this comes from. Is this a borrowing from Christianity to Islam, into Sufism, or rather more likely, is it a borrowing from Buddhism into Islam and then into Christianity? That's one set of possibilities. Yes, the labyrinths are fascinating. I don't actually know if anyone's made that link, but it would be perfectly possible for it to be plausible. And it's the right period, 12th century, there are people in the right places to bring it back.
Hi. My name is Sam Tota. I'm from Constantinople, and today it's called Istanbul. I have the question that when you study history, I almost felt that you were doing it like the economists study the economy. They freeze certain events, and they say everything else remaining constant, then they study it. So listening to you, I have one special event that you left out of the Jews. 1492, the expulsion of the Jews from Spain had a major effect about some of the events that you are mentioning. I know the lecture is about Christianity and Islam. I lived through that. But why would you leave out such an important event that had an effect?
Time. On the thing? Yeah. And more to the point that you've hit on, of course, one of the hugely important dates of Western history and Mediterranean history in particular. But there is a set of relations primarily between Judaism and Islam, a very positive set. And it's actually, it would be a good example to take if I'd had the time, because it's a perfect example of the way in which two of the great world faiths combine against another one in particular circumstances. Because as you well know, so many of the expellees from the Iberian Peninsula go to Thessalonica, go to the East, because they are welcomed by the Ottoman Empire, which saw the Habsburg monarchies as one of the greatest threats to its expansion. And so it's obvious that they should ally with these oppressed people and give them hospitality. I mean, it's one of the most heartening stories in the history of the Ottoman Empire, I think, that at that moment so many Jews would go east, into the Ottoman Empire. And the fact that until the catastrophe of the 1940s, it was still possible to hear medieval Spanish in Thessalonica is a wonderful tribute to that particular act of generosity.
Do you have any thoughts why something like Renaissance never happened in the Islamic world?
Why didn't the Renaissance happen in the Islamic world? Well, of course, it also did not happen in Orthodox Christianity. And that suggests that this is not something to do with the character of Islam. It's the character of, perhaps one might say, Western Europe. Now, one of the factors, clearly, is that Western Europeans, about 1350 onwards, became fascinated with pre-Christian Latin and Greek literature. Now, Byzantium had begun to look at this same material in the 12th century, and the then elites, the emperor, the church, decided to crush that impulse. They felt particularly threatened at the time by Islamic pressure, so I think that may be one reason. So these things could happen. I think there's that great debate in Islam earlier about the status of the Quran. Is it something co-eternal with Allah, or is it a creation of Allah for the benefit of human beings? If it is the first, then that gives the way open to perhaps not all that much. But if you say that the Quran is created, then it may be that you can look at other sources of wisdom as well. And you see in that debate, I think, the same sort of debate which happened slightly later in Byzantium about whether it is right or proper to use Aristotle or Plato in Christianity. Well, the answer in the West in the end is yes, they have wisdom which we can use not just for technical things, biology, engineering, but also for theological analysis. So I think it's much more a question of why the West keeps it on than why Islam and Orthodoxy don't.
I'm a librarian and really interested in the history of libraries and books and printing and such. Also in the destruction of libraries and knowledge through history. And some of the great destructions of libraries have happened right on this sort of border between Christianity and Islam. One of the accounts of the destruction of the Library of Alexandria has Caliph Umar ordering that every book be burned to heat the baths of the soldiers. Maybe a myth that started in the Crusade years. The loss of the library at Constantinople, which is maybe where a lot of those Library of Alexandria materials came during the fall of Constantinople. Maybe it ended up in Russia, but that's a library that's lost that contains, or that's thought to contain, a number of these classical and exciting works. I was just hoping you could comment on that, the loss of that kind of knowledge, maybe both traditions' attempts to preserve such knowledge or to destroy or get rid of such knowledge.
Well, yes, I'm also a librarian at heart, and one thinks of the tragedy of Sarajevo
only 20 years ago as another library lost. But Western Christians can do it to Western Christians. So the library at Leuven was lost and when the Germans burnt it in the First World War. The Czartoryski Library lost in Warsaw. So these are not illustrations of, again, the clash of civilizations. I think the Alexandrian example, which you mentioned, is very interesting because it does appear to be a complete myth that the library disintegrated under Christian care, not under any particular act of Islamic invaders. Libraries go when people don't value them or fear them. That is why the library in Sarajevo was burnt. It is why Christians, Catholic Christians, burnt the books of Diophysite Christians in India in the 16th century. When they turned up, they burned the heretical libraries of the local bishops before actually burning those bishops as well. So it's one of the regrettable facts about us animals, us human beings, us pattern-making animals, that we love destroying other people's patterns. And one way is to destroy the libraries which encapsulate those patterns.
J'aimerais dire d'abord juste quelques points. L'Institut d'études canadiennes de McGill est fier de s'associer au prix Crandall. And I would just like to, first of all, thank Professor Zucchi for moderating the question period. Professor McCullough, on behalf of McGill, the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, I'd like to thank you for this extremely thought-provoking lecture. I mean, hearing that you'd cut stuff out, I could have gone on, I'm sure, like most of us, for another hour or so. So the Kundal Prize would like to offer you this plaque as a token of its appreciation for your lecture and for being the third Kundal Prize winner. And I'd like to thank you all for coming and invite you to join us for a glass of wine in the main lounge next door.